Before the close, the Dow was up 20 or down 22 points at 27,002. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're in a couple of places at once, meeting two young adults, and they have something in common.
I'm Camilla Higgins. I am 23 years old.
My name is Albert. I'm 28 years old.
Camilla is getting a master's in education to be a teacher. Albert works as an instructional aide at the nearby middle school. So yeah, they both work with kids, but they've got one other thing in common.
They live at home with my parents. Woohoo!
This is a typical story, especially in Los Angeles. For the first time in more than a century, adults under 34 are more likely to live with their parents than live alone or with roommates or even with a spouse. About a third of young adults live at home with their parents all across the country. In Los Angeles, that number is more than 40%. KCRW's Kaylee Wells paid a visit to these adults in their childhood homes to find out why they're there and how their parents feel about it.
It's quiet at Camilla's house in Pasadena. Apart from Charlotte Bronte, the family cocker spaniel, who switches between lounging on the floral print couch and greeting anyone who comes to the door.
Hello.
I should just pretend.
It's okay. I have a dog.
That's Camilla's mom. Camilla is the youngest of her three kids. All the kids moved out for college and came back to live in this house afterwards. The older two have since moved out. It's just Camilla and her parents now in a five-bedroom, four-bathroom home.
I'm extremely lucky that they let me come back because I would not be able to afford living in Los Angeles at all. I go to school full-time and I work part-time. Whew. So I do not have enough money to pay $1,000+ of rent. It's just not going to happen.
Camilla's not alone. Experts say there's several factors at play in this trend. USC professor Gary Painter says the housing crisis is probably related, but that's not the root of the cause.
People who are 18 to 34 are taking longer to establish their careers. They're taking longer to get married. And therefore, it makes sense that their household formation rates would be lower. And if you delay that phenomenon of establishing a partner relationship and or having children, then it also changes the trajectory of when you start your housing career.
So they're marrying later and saving money in the midst of a housing crisis. But he says Los Angeles is a diverse city, and there's a group of young adults who've been doing this for a while.
You're much more likely if you're from an immigrant family, so you could be second generation, your parents first generation, or you could be third and your parents second. You're much more likely to stay home longer and then make the jump into your housing career than if you were not from that background.
Camilla is white, and she's sixth generation Californian on both sides. She fits into Painter's first category. She went to college in Virginia. She worked there for a year before going back to school at USC to get her master's. And she works part-time now, teaching adult English classes. She's saving all her income and has a goal of getting a job and moving out within 6 months of graduation. But in the meantime, she's home because living alone in LA is expensive.
It's tough because if you want to live in Los Angeles and you don't want to be somewhere that has tons of traffic or that may be inconvenient or maybe even unsafe, you generally are going to have to pay upwards of $900. And that's like on the low end. And if I could just stay at home and not have to pay that, then yeah, of course I will stay at home.
And so do all her friends. Her boyfriend who works in Hollywood lives at home. So does a friend in marketing and another friend who works as a consultant.
In my generation, barely anyone went back home and lived. It wasn't encouraged, it wasn't discouraged, but it just wasn't the norm at all. We all left and, you know, lived like paupers, but that's just how it went.
That's Annie Higgins, Camilla's mom.
It's expensive to live. And for some reason, just the world has changed or culture has changed or it's more acceptable. kids think, okay, I'm graduating from college, I'm going to come home. And that, again, was something so foreign to my generation.
Annie started seeing her friends' kids move back home from college, so she wasn't surprised when her kids wanted to do the same thing. Camilla's older siblings spent a couple years here before they moved out on their own.
You just feel it as a parent or a mother that it's time to move on, but most of them feel it about the same time, too, so it was never an ugly situation.
She says it was a great gift for them to save money and figure out what they wanted to do.
I thought maybe to charge them rent, but I don't know, I didn't have the heart.
Over in Compton, Albert Reyes is coming home from a day at work to the house he grew up in. Albert fits that second category Painter talks about that's more typical for immigrants. His parents came to the U.S. from Mexico when they were 16 and 20 years old, and they want their kids to stay home.
My folks like the fact that we're at home because they had to leave home. If they left home and they struggled, they don't want us to have that similar situation. Even if we're making good money and we can do it on our own, they'd rather be like, no, just save money and give us this amount. We're cool, you know, just stay here around. They kind of don't want us to leave the nest too soon if we don't have to.
His commute from work is the shortest, so he's home before everyone else. But around dinner time, his home gets a little fuller.
It's my mom and my dad, my siblings, all four of them, my sister and my two brothers, her four children, and then two tenants that live here.
It's a three-bedroom home. His brother share a room, the parents share a room, the sister and her four kids share a room. The garage in the back was converted into three different bedrooms. Each of the two tenants has one, and Albert has the last room in the very back.
I get here first because I work 3 minutes away from home, but my mom just got home, so she's cooking right now. After that, my sister and her two kids come, and then she goes back and picks
up. He's 28 now, but his parents aren't worried about getting him out of the house.
In my situation, because I have no kids, I am not with anybody, I'm still trying to figure out what's going on with my career, they don't really push me too much to get out of the house. And if anything, I prefer to give them the money I would give someone else, because that way the money stays within the family.
Like Camilla, Albert went to college, but he never left home. He commuted from his parents' house to Cal State LA. He says as soon as he graduated, he got a job and his parents expected him to pay rent. He pays between $500 and $600 a month. That covers his share of the house and utilities. It also pays for car insurance for all three of the family's cars. The expenses might be nice, but living at home doesn't come without its problems for Albert or Camilla. They say it's just like having housemates.
I would really love to have my own kitchen. I love to cook, and my dad also loves to cook, but he never cleans, which is really annoying.
Camilla also has a boyfriend of 6 years, but he's not allowed to spend the night. And since her parents pay the bills, it's their rules. Albert, who's openly gay, says privacy is one of his biggest sacrifices, too.
We kind of have to be a little quiet because I do have thin walls. If I want to have a guy over, I got to be real careful about it. After hours, everybody's asleep.
But he says with the privacy of living on his own would come loneliness, and that's not worth it. So for now, Albert and Camilla are comfortable, and they're driven by dreams of finding a fulfilling career and saving up money to be independent one day soon. Camilla also wants to own a house someday, but if it's a choice between that and leaving...
I don't think I would move out of LA, truthfully. Mm-hmm. I think I would stay closer to family. I would rent.
Albert says his parents want him to be a homeowner one day, but that's not important to him. He'd rather use that money to make his parents comfortable as they get older, even if that means leaving LA. For a bit.
If I found the dream job and it was outside of California in general, I would leave. But I would come back because this is home. I don't breathe the same air when I go somewhere else. I've traveled the world and I feel like I'm out of place. So I would eventually find a way to come back and even come back home because nothing beats just being comfortable.
For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
So what is your experience? Did you move back home with mom or dad? Did you or do you have children who have moved back in with you?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You. We'd love to hear about your experience. Just drop a note at our website, kcrw.com/greater LA. Well, coming up, the mayor talks climate on the earth and on the streets of Los Angeles. It's Greater LA on KCRW.
Support comes from Berkeley Hall School, a nursery through 8th grade independent school on Mulholland, where challenging academics are coupled with a love of learning, leadership with social responsibility, creativity with moral integrity, and self-esteem with compassion for others. Deeply grounded in community, the school empowers children to be fearless scholars and conscientious citizens. Tour Berkeley Hall this fall to experience their mountaintop campus. Learn more at berkeleyhall.org.
Support comes from Segerstrom Center for the Arts in Costa Mesa, presenting Grammy Award winner Lila Downs with her new show, Día de Muertos al Chile, on Sunday, October 27th at 7 p.m. The acclaimed singer will be joined by Grandeza Mexicana Folk Ballet Company and Mariachi Femenil Flores Mexicanas for this colorful and inspiring Day of the Dead celebration. Tickets for Lila Downs at Segerstrom Center on October 27th, available at scfta.org.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Last week, dozens of big city mayors from all around the world got together in Denmark to talk climate change. The cities are all members of an organization called C40, which organized the four-day conference. And on the first day, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti was elected as the group's new chair. Well, he's back at City Hall today, and he joins me right now on the line. Mr. Mayor, congratulations on your new position.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. This is absolutely the fight of our lives.
Well, when it comes to fighting climate change, cities obviously do not control the big national level levers of policy power. What do you think are the things that cities can do, and how much of an impact can the cities have?
Well, I would say cities are more important than national governments. I remind people that as bad as it is to have somebody in the White House who is one of the last deniers of climate change left in the world, even if it was President Hillary Clinton, it was cities that control our transportation networks, write our building codes, look at how we generate our electricity. And most of the work in the world actually comes down to that local level. And when we are together at C40 in Copenhagen, we have 94 cities that are a part of this network now, representing a quarter of the world's GDP and probably about 30% of our global emissions. So just this one group alone of putting Tokyo and Shanghai and Karachi and, you know, Paris and Mexico City and Buenos Aires and LA together, we're accelerating the work that we're doing together. And when people are starting to feel depressed about this fight, one of the good news pieces we announced is that 30 cities, including Los Angeles, have already peaked their emissions and are heading down. So while we see many others who need to step up and to match that, this is a solvable problem, and it will run through the cities no matter who our national leaders are, even as we look for better ones.
And you all signed a Green New Deal, so I want to ask you what's involved in that, and how is it different, do you think, from LA's own Green New Deal?
Well, we kind of have the best of both worlds. As Washington struggles to figure out what the Green New Deal will mean at a national level, we put forward LA's, which is detailed 61 things in 14 categories, from recycling our water so we don't have to steal it from other places in a drought, to, you know, some of the solar and wind energy, like the deal we did 2 weeks ago that was the biggest solar energy and storage deal in American history at less of the price than gas costs to generate electricity. We also now now wanted to take this globally and really combine the two things that I think give people the greatest anxiety in the world. A, will the world survive as we know it? And B, if it does, will there be a place in it for me in terms of a good job that I can support my family? So the idea behind the Global Green New Deal was to build on LA's experience, where we've added 35,000 green jobs just since I've been mayor, good paying, long-lasting careers, and transforming how we move, how we generate electricity, how we live in the buildings where we work and live. And we think that can be done on a global scale. In fact, we need to do it. And as opposed to in the past, when people said you can either save the earth or save jobs, we know the two now go together. You can't do one without the other.
I want to talk about some other issues that are facing LA. You just held a press conference downtown on homelessness. It's a topic that we've been talking a lot about on this radio station, certainly in the news world in general. We just had a segment, as a matter of fact, on the show about young adults who choose to stay in their childhood homes a lot longer, way even into adulthood or even middle age, because it's so expensive to live here. You know, we passed a couple of measures a few years ago to help fund homeless services and housing, and yet it doesn't feel like any of it is helping. I mean, where is all that money going?
Well, there's no question it is helping, and Los Angeles is seen as the model, which is a tough thing to see and to feel when you look out there and you still see tents. But I've told people there is no solution where you can snap your fingers, sweep this away, or expect it disappears overnight when it's been decades in the making. But you also should not give up on the idea that this is not a solvable problem. In other words, we've in just 4 years gone from housing 9,000 people a year to 21,000 just last year. And this was before we saw the measures, which just passed 2 and 2.5 years ago, really come online. Now we have 151 permanent housing projects, not apartments, but those are each buildings themselves. They will total more than 10,000 units. And I gave a briefing today on the 3,000 plus that were just approved by City Council yesterday. In this last month, since I did my last homelessness briefing, which I'm now doing monthly, we opened up 4 new shelters, Bridge Home Shelters, and we have another 18 on tap by July 1st of next year. So, you know, I tell people, don't give up your impatience. I certainly don't. And the city of LA, I remind them, can only do one piece of this. We don't control hospitals or mental health. We don't control the jail system or veterans coming home, the foster care system. When people like President Trump or Governor Newsom are focused on homelessness, regardless of what we think of each one of their politics, and I'm certainly a fan of Governor Newsom's and not President Trump's, we need everybody hands-on on this fight. And we need to have the patience. Anybody who's ever had mental health or substance abuse in their own family knows that these are painstaking, difficult issues to deal with. And those who are economically displaced, we need to continue building housing. But I'm proud of LA. We're building 25% of all the housing in California last month in a city that's only 10% of the population. We now need our partner cities around us and the state and federal government to step up as well. But this is a solvable problem, and I'm kind of like a fireman. You know, when other people run away from it politically, I run to the fire, and I will continue doing that because I know how important this is. And if climate change is the fight of our lives, this is the fight of the moment.
Well, we know when you're running, you step into some things. And can I play a clip for you from television?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. I'm not in the business, by the way, of plugging any comedian or talk show host, but Bill Maher said something really interesting on his HBO show. I don't know if you saw it.
No.
About that homeless money. So give a listen to this.
In the bond measure we passed in 2016 to build housing for the homeless, each unit was projected to cost $140,000. And now that we're actually building these apartments, the cost for each unit has risen to $531,000. About 40% of that cost goes to something the city calls soft costs, and I call bullshit costs.
That was Bill Maher during his new rules segment last week. So what do you say to that? And why is it taking so long to get this stuff built? You mentioned a lot of numbers. They are getting built. But aren't going away.
I don't want anybody to think those numbers are correct. Those are absolutely factually incorrect numbers. Any unit of housing has always cost us between $400,000 and $550,000. The subsidy that taxpayer money goes to is and remains exactly on the target that he said. We are, in fact, subsidizing about $151,000 of that. So in other words, what he called soft costs and are not BS are the other pieces from rent, from donations, from other places like tax credits that a builder will put into getting a unit done. And remember, the cost of these buildings, the units are actually much cheaper than that. But many of these places, because we want people to stay off the street for good, include mental health facilities. They include the services that they need, job training, child care. So if you divide that into per unit, yeah, they're a little bit more expensive than market rate. But the taxpayer themselves, through our measures, is exactly spot on with the $150,000 roughly that we said. And we just put a competition out there because I want to see those costs come down even more. And we're doing it for about a third less with another 1,000 units we just approved yesterday in City Council, using everything from shipping containers to existing buildings, prefabrication. So those numbers, he was mixing up two different things. Totally wrong. It's always cost to build that apartment about the amount that we're coming in at, in the face of steel costs going up, labor shortages, and the tax deal that was passed in Washington that dried up the tax credit market.
I think the gist of what he was trying to say was the fact that a lot of people are lining their pockets, and not necessarily at the city level, but through the process of getting all this stuff done, construction costs, and that's what he, that, again, take it up with Bill Maher, but that's what he said on his show. So
yeah, and I'm more than happy. I like Bill a lot, and I wouldn't want him to get mixed up, but I want people out there who are listening to know absolutely crystal clear, those two things are never what the estimate was and what it's gone up to. The subsidy is about a third of the overall cost, and that's what we're coming in at.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
We ran a story recently about the anger that's out there on the issue of homelessness. Our reporters actually spoke to a man. I want to play another clip. This is a guy named Demetrios. Listen to this.
Now the neighbors have teamed up in our neighborhood, and we're literally forming vigilante groups. And I'm not saying going out there to hurt people, but because the police can't help us, our council members failed us miserably, we are empowering ourselves to go out there and police our own neighborhoods.
So people are getting angry at all the people on the streets. They feel like, you know, the politicians aren't doing much or just giving lip service. What do you say to that, that people are out there right now, some of which, I mean, there's a lot of harassment of homeless people on the streets.
Yeah, there's a frustration that's out there that, look, it's not. The nice thing about being mayor is I don't leave town for work. I get woken up at 3 a.m. by the person screaming down the block at my house two or three times a week. I go out there myself. I'm worried about my own family, and I get those stories of people. And it's very important not to, you know, we know there's a criminal element of people who are housed, and we know that there's a mental health problem with people who are housed, and we know that there are people on the street who are not criminals. In fact, overwhelmingly, they're not, and often the victims most are the people on the streets. So I always tell people, kind of, we got to disconnect the two things. What's the long-term solution to homelessness, and what's the short-term answer? Short-term, if you care about that in your community, you have to say yes to shelter and yes to housing, which we're seeing all over the city. Second, though, if there's public safety issues, absolutely you deserve that police will be there. I didn't pass some of the laws that we see right now where there's really no stick that gets people into drug treatment, where there's no consequence for the use of drugs. And we want to not put people away for 20 years for a gram of something too much. But if people come out and there's nothing to catch them, there's no program. And if you and I break our legs, we'll go to the emergency room hospital and be seen by somebody. But if you and I have an addiction problem, there's no program waiting for you. I'm as loud and frustrated as anybody calling on the state and the county to up those beds, to get more programs to deal with what underlies this. But if there's ever public safety issues, whether it was in Venice when we had our town hall and people said, look, on the beach, we need more patrols, we got them there the next week. And, you know, those are the sorts of things that are my job. This is the lowest crime rate we've had in 50 years, but that doesn't mean anything if you've had an experience yourself. And so I would encourage people to work with their senior lead officers, with LAPD. They are not handcuffed. There's no orders from City Hall that they can't address criminal behavior, even if somebody is homeless. And that's the best way we can continue to be partners in bringing crime down even more.
What's your visceral reaction when President Trump uses L.A. as an example of a city that's not addressing its homeless issue, and also, you know, hey, maybe we should let the federal government get involved?
Well, I'd like to know what that means more than abstract, because we all know we have a constitution and they haven't come up with any ideas. That said, I don't punch back and try to score political points the way I think his playbook is. I wrote him a letter saying, here's five things you could do right now. If the federal government wants to help, absolutely step in. You've got property, you've got money, and here's the most important thing if we really want to understand this issue. If you and I qualify for food stamps because we're hungry, 100%, we get it. If you or I are poor and we need health care, we get Medicaid or Medi-Cal. But if you or I qualify for housing, there's a 1 in 8 chance that we will get it. So if the federal government wanted to step up and end homelessness, they could make that, just like other entitlements, 100%. And in this city, we would see a drastic reduction. And most countries that have successfully done it, he cited Japan. Japan had a homelessness problem a few years back, and they solved it by guaranteeing those homeless folks that were on the street would get housing, 100% of them. And that's something that only the federal government has the scale to do. Thanks to the voters, we've taxed ourselves twice. We're seeing our increase be much less than other parts of California. We're seeing twice as many people coming off the streets as 4 years ago. We're seeing veterans homelessness down 80%. But I agree with everybody out there, just as an Angeleno who still sees too many tents. And this is the humanitarian crisis of this moment. And if on his watch with his constituents he wants to do something, step on up, Mr. President.
L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, thank you so much for your time, sir.
You bet, Steve. Good to talk to you.
By the way, we did some fact-checking, and indeed, the mayor is right. The city never claimed from the beginning that the total cost for homeless housing units would be $140,000. That is the amount that the city is contributing toward each unit. The mayor says it's actually, you just heard him say, about $150,000 per unit. That's true. So even though the per-unit cost has ballooned to about $530,000, according to a recent city controller's audit, Bill Maher being right about that number, the city and Angeleno tax money will not pay that total per unit tab. It will still be paying about $140,000 or $150,000. So we just wanted to clear that up. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, sometimes when you feel helpless about helping the homeless, you take matters into your own hands. You'll meet one woman in Long Beach who did just that, to help the homeless. Next on KCRW, all the president's lawyers, Josh Barrow and Ken White, will join us in the latest on the impeachment saga. A lot of legality going on in that realm. I hope you'll stay tuned. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl make our show happen each and every day. Thank them for their support, and I thank them. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Give us your thoughts about the show and the things we talked about today, and leave us those comments online. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the time. Thanks for your ear. Have a great Wednesday.
There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if there's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You are listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me as always. He's my co-host. He's a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor, and he blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So Donald Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani,